Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Last week, we saw an announcement from the administration that it would adhere to the 8 Midwest governors' request for year-round E15. I welcome this. I think it's long overdue, and I applaud the work of both Governor Kim Reynolds and Attorney General Brenna Byrd. But we know that pushing off implementation until 2025 is very discouraging for those in that area.
Iowa Senator Joni Ernst with Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
So with the 2024 summer driving season approaching, Iowa families, our corn farmers, our ethanol producers, and the fuel retailers still have no idea if E15 will be at the pump this summer. Hearing some of the statements that you have made, it appears as if you are confident that the EPA will announce another emergency waiver. Is that correct?
That's correct.
This is Agriculture Today.
The Ag Economy Barometer Index rose 5 points this month compared to a month earlier, but that left the index 14 points below where it was this time last year.
Dr. Jim Mentert is director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture, looking at the February Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer.
The current condition index was unchanged compared to last month, but it is down 31 points compared to February of 2023. And the future expectation index was actually up 7 points compared to last month, but it remains 6 points lower than it was a year ago. The Farm Financial Performance Index reading of 84 was down 1 point compared to a month ago and 2 points lower than a year ago, but the index remains well below its peak of last fall when it hit a level of 97. Once again, in this month's survey, we asked producers what their biggest concerns are for their farming operation in the upcoming year. And the top concern remains higher input costs, chosen by 34% of this month's respondents. But 28% of the respondents this month chose lower crop and or livestock prices. That's up from 18% who chose that a year ago. The Farm Capital Investment Index reading of 34 was 1 point below a month ago and was 9 points lower than it was this time last year. When we followed up and asked producers who said it's a bad time to make large investments in their farming operation why they felt that way, there's been a bit of a change. Rising interest rates was the number one reason cited by farmers, but uncertainty about profitability is up sharply compared to responses we received last fall. Producers' perspective on farmland values in the upcoming year were unchanged this month. The short-term index was unchanged from a month earlier, but was down 4 points compared to a year ago, with this month's reading of 115. Once again, this month's survey asked producers about lease rates for solar energy production on their farms. And it's become clear that lease rates are rising over time. The first time we asked this question, just 27% of producers said they were offered a lease rate of over $1,000 an acre. In this month's survey, over half, 56% of producers in the survey said they were offered a lease rate of over $1,000 per acre.
We turn from the barometer to disaster relief programs in the aftermath of wildfires. Amy Hagerman is an Oklahoma State Extension Ag Policy Specialist on the importance of documentation.
We can take that one step further and think about how we're going to use that documentation in the days and weeks ahead. It's important for a lot of reasons, but not least of which is when you go in to talk to your Farm Service Agency about disaster programs. So when we're thinking about our livestock producers, first of all, safety is first. Make sure it's safe to go in and get that documentation. Then after you have some of that documentation, contact your Farm Service Agency about a program called the Livestock Indemnity Program. This is a program that helps pay producers when they have excessive death losses in their cattle herds. So if you lost cattle associated with one of these wildfires, I would encourage you to take advantage of this program. Let them know that you have experienced an excessive loss associated with wildfire. Then they will give you the additional information for your application and let you know what documentation is appropriate to apply for that program. So as you have these conversations in the days and weeks ahead, just keep in mind that there are disaster programs available to help you with recovery. OSU Extension's website has a lot of great resources for recovery as well. So if you want to go in and look at how to help your pastures recover from fire, how to reduce fuel for fire going forward into the days and weeks ahead, go to sunup.okstate.edu.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This effort on exports also involves engagement.
Speaking recently at Commodity Classic, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
I had the opportunity to physically meet with the Chinese Ag Minister. We had an exchange of ideas. We had a commitment to work collaboratively on issues of significance to both China and the United States, understanding that our relationship in agriculture is an important one. It's important to us because it's a significant market. It's important to them because they are not a food secure nation as we are. They don't have the level of productivity and the enormous land mass and the water resources that we have. And the result is that they are dependent on others for food. And we are more than willing to do our part in providing that. So we will see a closer working relationship on issues related to climate change, related to ways in which technology, biotechnology specifically, can be utilized in order to increase productivity and to be able to assure that those commodities using biotechnology are made available in the marketplace. Engagement also involves our other two top customers, Mexico and Canada. And for that reason, I'm announcing today that I will have a trilateral meeting with the ministers from Canada and the secretary from Mexico later this month, likely in Colorado, to have an opportunity for us to discuss areas of mutual concern, for me to continue to raise the concern we have in Mexico in their approach to biotechnology in terms of corn, and for me to also raise the need for Canada to continue to look for ways in which their dairy market can be more open to it. This effort on exports also involves enforcing trade agreements, which we are doing in a variety of ways, Mexico and Canada being two areas. It also involves reducing barriers, focusing on individual trade barriers that exist in countries around the world to our products. It's one of the reasons why I was happy to note that ethanol exports are up, and one of the reasons is that we're beginning to see other countries understand and appreciate the necessity of having higher volumes of blended fuel in their gas consumption. Japan indicating recently a willingness to increase their level of biofuel is as an example. These are all negotiated, all encouraged by us at USDA in order to enhance opportunities for exports. So there's a concerted and committed effort in exports. We'll continue to work with the U.S. Trade Representative's Office to ensure that we continue to focus on new opportunities, particularly in the Indo-Pacific area, the trade framework that's being discussed with a number of countries that could open up additional opportunities. But in addition to the export markets, we also obviously have to look at ways in which we can expand domestic consumption as we deal with the supply issue. And obviously, I want to acknowledge the work of EPA recently in announcing the intent to make available E15 on a year-round basis in a number of states. I've worked closely with the administrator on these issues, and I'm obviously will continue to work closely with him as he and the folks at EPA make additional decisions relative to E15 in this year of 2024. I would say that he has been a cooperative partner with us in this expansion of E15. We've already done, since I came back to this job, 154 grants to expand the distribution systems for higher blends. That's just the beginning. We've now seen E15 being available in 30 states across the country. That's an increase. We've seen a record level of the volume of renewable fuels being used by American consumers. We've seen a return to profitability, and we're obviously going to continue to see ways in which we can help this industry.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So one of my fixations is, how do you stabilize borrowing so that borrowing equals what our economic growth is?
Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
Here's the growth of the country, and here's the debt of the country. If you could ever bring the GDP growth and the debt in line, you've created stability. But we have some crazy headwinds. There's also some crazy opportunities happening. There are good things happening out there. Will Congress be the barrier or the adoption of them? Because right now we are the problem, because we're scared of our own shadows. So if I came to you right now and said, let's come up with a way to stabilize Social Security. Let's stabilize Medicare. It's moral. It's our moral obligation. We made a social contract in this society. We got a problem. And it's all something almost no one here ever talks about. We're not having children. United States fertility rates have collapsed. This number's wrong. It's our latest number for last year is not 1.64, it's 1.63. France has a higher fertility rate than the United States. Even when you adjust for their immigration population, they still have a dramatically higher fertility. Most of Western Europe looks like us, and we're worse than a whole bunch of the world. How do you and I set public policy so 25 years from now, remember, Social Security is substantially a pay-as-you-go system. Today's workers are functionally paying for today's retirees. The trust fund was the shock absorber. Trust fund is disappearing. But my future generation of workers is going to be smaller. And you're already seeing this in school districts all over America, where the number of students they have are shrinking. Are we willing to have the really interesting discussion of, okay, are there things we could do economically to make it so family formation, so there's more children? There's things we could do to help, but almost every country it's tried has not been able to change fertility rates. There's, I think in Hungary, I think I saw something that, you know, third child, they buy you a house, fourth child, you get some sort of like prize, and it's barely ticked up their fertility rates. It's a really difficult question, happening all over the industrialized world. So if you can't really change it, do you actually build public policy to deal with it? Do you accept the fact that we're going to have a lot more automation? It means capital investment. Are we going to have to find ways to safely adopt artificial intelligence into society so the labor force is maximized in its value and what they earn and productivity? Those are policies we need to work on. You've seen the intellectual capital of the conversations we have on the floor here. How many of them are ready to actually have the reality of, hey, we need to set policy. Is this Republican or Democrat? It's demographics. It's life. And then this is a little uncomfortable, but this was deaths that are projected to exceed births. And the new math in 15 years, you got to understand what a big deal this is. And I think at that time I was saying, hey, in 21, 22 years, we're going to have more deaths than births in this country. And then it became 18 years. And then it became 17 years. The new math now is 15 years. In 15 years, the United States will have more deaths than births. The blip you see here is the pandemic. But if you actually look at the line, you can sort of understand, and here's our crossing. Somewhere a little before 2040, which is 15 years, now try to stabilize long-term benefits. There's ways to do it. Well, we can't even put together a debt and deficit commission to have an honest conversation. What's happening in our society demographically, borrowing-wise, interest rate-wise? Because maybe it'll affect the next election. This inflation cycle didn't prove. Those who believed in modern monetary policy, ta-da, you got 30 months, 36 months of high inflation. If that isn't the ultimate proof that the magic money theory didn't work.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The background is, in 2020, Mexico released an initial biotech decree that would have banned the import of all corn with biotech traits. They updated that decree basically this time last year, February of 2023.
Andrew Brandt with the U.S. Grains Council.
The updated decree in the immediate removed the ban on importing yellow corn for feed use, essentially, so the livestock industry kind of carving that out, but still saying basically no white biotech corn that can be used in food products. So that remains as an issue where they are saying biotech white corn is still unsafe for human consumption. We, of course, object to that. Using science-based regulatory systems, biotechnology is certainly safe for people, whether you're putting in a tortilla or, you know, anything else, feeding it to animals to create a pork chop or a nice steak. Biotechnology is proven safe. We've never had an issue. And so the decree they have violates, the USMCA's biotech agreement and, the way they are supposed to regulate biotechnology in a transparent way. If they want to claim that biotechnology is not safe, they have to prove that with science, which they have not done. So we are very thankful the USTR late last summer filed an official dispute case under the USMCA. We're very thankful for that. That case is now proceeding. Inside the USMCA, there is a framework of things that have to kind of play out procedurally. We are currently going through all that, but the good news is, on the whole, everything is looking good. That's not to say we can guarantee victory, but if this thing plays out and the panel makes a decision based on science, that's all we can ask for and what we hope happens.
U.S. is arguing under the most recent agreement, the USMCA, which passed during the Trump administration. There's been no new free trade agreements since then?
That was the last trade agreement. That was kind of technically more an update than necessarily a new trade agreement, but still considered the last trade agreement we passed through Congress, and it did pass overwhelmingly. I think it got 85 votes in the Senate. It was overwhelmingly approved. Moving forward, though, you know, we certainly would like to see engagement. Agriculture, we have a surplus in the U.S., so we need to find markets overseas to move our product. The Biden administration was engaged in what they called the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. In a sense, this was a way to try and engage Southeast Asia. They've got a growing population, a growing middle class, try and create an economic framework to enhance our ability to access those markets, synchronize regulations like SPS, things like that. Was not necessarily a free trade agreement in the sense we came to know them in the heyday of free trade agreements in the mid-2000s. But still, a significant potential agreement that over time could open markets and, perhaps as a stepping stone to the future, probably speaking in decades here, but, something bigger in the future. Unfortunately, that's kind of at the moment, we'll say it's paused. Trade is more controversial today than, say, it was a decade ago. But hopefully we'll be able to move past that. And, another point I like to make out is even though the United States is not highly engaged in free trade agreements, a lot of the other countries in the world are still doing free trade agreements. So even though we have kind of, hit the pause button on signing these things, let's make no mistake, other countries are doing them and, tearing down barriers. And so if they're going to do free trade agreements and potentially give, better market access or lower tariff access to some of these markets, that could, over time, impact us pretty significantly.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's difficult to go to work every single day knowing that there are folks out there who are struggling mightily.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack at a fireside chat at Commodity Classic.
88% of farmers in this country work off the farm. So I'm asking myself, if it takes two incomes to keep the farm going, why is it that the farmer has to work two jobs? Why can't we figure out how the farm can get two income streams or three income streams or four income streams? And that requires a different thought process, a thought process that doesn't just focus on production, which is where our thought process has been for since the 1970s when Earl Butz and this job basically told farmers to go fence row to fence row, and by golly, they did. It is to also understand that there needs to be some level of profitability at the end of the day. And that for small and mid-sized producers, that there's it's difficult because the reality is when you're growing a commodity, you have to grow a lot of it, which means you have to have a big operation and equipment and expenses and so forth. Isn't there a way with climate-smart agriculture, with local and regional food systems, with ecosystem service markets, with sustainable aviation fuel and the conversion of multiple ways from agricultural waste to produce another revenue stream, aren't there ways in which we can be smarter and better? And I think in order to do that, we need to make sure there's a partnership between the USDA and other agencies so that other agencies appreciate how they intersect the world of these farmers and ranchers. And I'll just finish with this, Chandler. I say this to audiences, but it bears repeating. We are an enormously powerful and great country because we have farmers who have freed us up, the rest of us who aren't farmers, to basically do whatever we want to do with our lives. In my case, to go to law school. My wife's case, to be a teacher. I didn't have to think about, how am I going to feed my family?
Right.
I just had to think about where I was going to get a paycheck.
Yeah.
Right? If I had a paycheck, I could feed my family because I just go to the grocery store. I never didn't dawn on me until I got this job and the job of being a governor that, wait a minute, I couldn't have had that choice but for the millions of folks out there who struggle every single day. And during the 1980s when we saw such turmoil, I represented farmers and I've never forgotten that experience, because when I represented them, I understood something very basic about them, which is that when you ask me what I do, and I tell you I'm a lawyer, That tells you what I do.
Right.
It does not tell you who I am. But when I ask anybody in this audience, what do you do? And you say, I farm. That tells me two things. It tells me what you do, but also tells me who you are. And we've got to make sure that we continue to honor that, and we need to preserve it, that we can't afford the only option for people in this convention to get big or ultimately to get out. We've got to figure out a way, and I think the president's instructed me to figure this out, how do we make it possible for farms of all sizes to have that opportunity? Because that's really, at the end of the day, what people want. I don't think America is okay with us losing 540,000 farms since I started practicing law. I don't think they're okay with us losing as much farmland as we've lost in that same time period. I think they want us to do what we can to preserve our nation as a food secure nation and to make sure that people who feed our families and feed the world's families are appreciated and understood.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Every second we borrow more, substantially more than the average wage of Americans. Maybe that hits home.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
We've been debating and fighting over things that don't even qualify as a day's borrowing. We bring this place to its knees. We remove a speaker. We do this and that. And then you realize the amount of dollars being fought over only equal a couple days worth of borrowing. But darn it, it got us on television. I got to raise some money on the internet. And it's that type of false profit that I will argue is our demise. Because if I can get you to fixate on the shiny objects, you're never going to be willing to absorb the truth on how ugly these numbers are. So this is where we're heading towards right now for 2024. Social Security will be our number one spend. Looks like it's baseline, though. It looks like it's ticking up. We're actually seeing something interesting where a number of retirees asking for benefits is actually ticking a little faster than we expected. But $1,450,000,000,000. So $1,450,000,000,000, number one spend in Social Security. Interest, both gross and potentially net, but gross interest now is our second biggest spend. And I just had to redo the math because our math right now looks like for 2024, we're going to cross $1.1 trillion of just interest this year. And I feel, I know for many people who are forced because you're employed to sit here and listen to an idiot like me talk, you've heard this before, but it doesn't seem to sink in. It's paying $1.1 trillion. Is that a Republican or Democrat? It's math. Yet we're not allowed to actually talk about it because the hallways in this place are full of people coming to our doors wanting more spending. And you point this out to them and they'll often say, well, take it from someone else. I want my money. It's not your money. It's the taxpayer's money. And Medicare is rising rapidly, healthcare costs. And then defense. For all of my brothers and sisters on the left who always say, cut defense, okay, yeah, it's sort of stupid, but it's the number four expense, it's not number one. How often would you and I go home to our constituents and say, what's the biggest spend in government? Oh, it's defense! No, defense is now number four. And at the trend line, in the next few years, healthcare will actually be number one, and interest will be number two. And Social Security, believe it or not, will be number three, are right tied to it. It's a very tight number there. All right, so let's actually walk through the 24 spend because I want to be able to get our heads around this. Social Security, and this was a fascinating number, and we've been trying to also average in what the new appropriations bills, remember, we're just now finishing up our 2024, so we're only 5 months late, is the net interest. Because the United States does something no other industrialized country does. We play a game with how we describe our borrowing. Oh, that's borrowing from the public. This is borrowing from the trust funds. So if anyone's listening right now and you question this, go on, what is it, the OECD. Go in and Google right now, or your favorite search engine, what is the debt to GDP of the United States according to OECD? And you're going to get a number, it's like 144%. Because they don't let the scam artists say, well, you borrowed it from yourself, but you still have to pay it back, and you're going to have to actually borrow money to pay it back while you're paying interest for it. It's a con. We should never allow discussions in this place and not use the terms gross borrowing because what? Is it magic money? We don't have to pay it back? It's just money we didn't have to go float publicly traded bonds, but we still have to pay it back. And the reason I built this chart is I wanted you to see a line right here. Even the net interest, so the publicly borrowed money, the interest we're going to pay on that, is still the second biggest spend in this government.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So we're functioning, what, 5 months into the fiscal year?
Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
We have added $1,443 billion, $1,243 billion in that 5 months. My current math is right now about every 123, 25 days at the current borrowing per day, we're adding another $1 trillion. This is in a time where the economy is pretty good. That means if my average since functionally October 1st is right now, we're borrowing about $7.9 billion every day. Got to understand what that ultimately means to us, because it's actually been accelerating. I think on Friday we set our all-time record. I think we were up to borrowing like $95,000 a second. Almost 100% of that growth is interest. And you're going to see this over and over in the charts, interest in healthcare costs.